Well, now, following on from our discussion yesterday afternoon about relativity and about the mutual interpenetration of every individual thing or event in the universe with every other one, and having previously discussed in the morning the yang-yin principle, the interrelation of the opposites, we are in a position to take a look at the meaning of this extraordinary classic of China, the Book of Changes, called the Yi Jing, not the Wai Ching. I'm afraid that the way that we romanize Chinese words bears very little resemblance to the way they're pronounced. That's because the scholars have a secret conspiracy to outgroup everybody else, because only if you're in the know do you know how to, the fact that it should be Jing when there's no apostrophe after the CH, but Qing when there is an apostrophe after the CH. And so it goes. So the Yi Jing, or the book, or Jing means a classical book, a scripture. The Sanskrit sutra is translated into Chinese by Jing. So the classical book. The book of Yi, which is change. It is suspected that the character for Yi was once a picture of a chameleon or lizard, and that because in the same way that the chameleon changes its color on whatever background it's put, so it came to mean change. But you see, in that idea of change, it isn't simple change. There's an idea of adaptation, an idea of harmonization with surroundings. And one of the basic ideas of Chinese thought about nature is a word that means resonance, as when tuning forks respond to each other. And so the resonance between any individual event and the context in which it occurs is one of the most important things that strike the Chinese mind. For example, if we take blood, blood in the veins is not the same thing as blood in a test tube, because it's in a different environment. It is not behaving in the same way. And to a very large extent is, you must say, that a thing is what it does. This I never tire of pointing out, this fundamental confusion in our thinking, by reason of the fact that grammar contains both nouns and verbs, and therefore gives the impression that there are two quite distinct classes of reality. One is process, denoted by verbs. The other is stuff, objects, entities, denoted by nouns. But actually, there is no need for this division, because all nouns, all so-called things, are processes. They are particular forms of behavior. And we never can possibly describe anything but their behavior. We can say what they do, but we never can say what they are, and we can never say what does things. There isn't any need for anything that does anything. All you need is doing, that is energy. And that's enough for anybody. What is energy? Well, look at it and you can see for yourself. You don't need to define energy. Just like mathematicians found out that for purposes of geometry, you don't need to define a point. You use points, but you don't say what they are. To say that a point is that which has position but no magnitude is a lot of nonsense. Position but no magnitude. this is gobbledygook. And it's based on human beings being confused by the words they use. So in this way then, in Chinese thought, the world is process and it's changes, because behavior is change. And so they watch the rhythm of behavior, and as you see, basically, one of the basic rhythms of behavior is a wave. Waves on the water. Waves of sound in the air, light waves. And the nature of a wave is that it's yang and yin. It has a crest and a trough. Now, you can't have a crest without a trough. You can't have half a wave. There is no such thing in nature as a half wave. So there are always full waves, at least one full wave in any energy system, and that implies a now you see it, now you don't, an up and a down, a crest and a trough. And those, the crest is the yang and the trough is the yin. Well, now the Book of Changes has a very mysterious history. And scholars are naturally disposed to believe that a great deal of this history is pure legend. But there was supposed to have been, many thousand years ago, a great sage emperor by the name of Fu Shi, who was followed in due course by a king whose name was Wen. And Fu Shi is said to have looked around and studied nature, and to have felt the forces in it, and to have invented what are called the Bagua, or the eight trigrams. Now you see, if you will arrange yang and yin, which are represented by broken and unbroken lines, unbroken line for yang, a broken line for yin. If you combine these in groupings of three, you have eight possible combinations. For example, three yang lines, which are unbroken, will then represent what the Chinese call Chen, or heaven. Three broken lines, being all yang, all female, will therefore represent the opposite of heaven, which is earth. Two broken lines on either side of one unbroken line will represent water, and the opposite arrangement, two unbroken lines on either side of one broken one, will represent fire. And so on until you get eight fundamental elements. And this called the Bakwa, you will see on the national flag of Korea. There it is, with the yang-yin symbol, the two interlocked black and white commas in the middle. And you will find this symbol of the yang-yin and the Bakwa on ever so many plates and Chinese objects, the backs of mirrors and things like that. It's a very common thing. And the idea is, you see, that it represents eight elements of the process of nature. Now, we used to say in the West, before in a pre-scientific age, that there were four elements, earth, water, fire, and air. And we got this from India. The Indians add another one, actually, called Akash, which is space. We say now that is pre-scientific gobbledygook, because actually there are how many elements today? 90-something have been established by chemistry. But it's the same sort of thing as saying there are three primary colors, so many colors in the spectrum, so many notes in the scale. It is simply that in order to describe nature, you have to divide it up some way. For example, in classifying people, there are various schemes that have been worked out. We talk about there being extroverts and introverts, and Jung made up his four functions so that he could describe intuitive types, sensation types, thinking types, and feeling types. Sheldon has his own special way where he can talk about ectomorphs, mesomorphs, and endomorphs, and then have them variously cerebrotonic, somatotonic, and viscerotonic. And he could combine these three in various ways. Now, a man like Aldous Huxley was quite obviously a cerebrotonic ectomorph, a long, skinny intellectual. But if you look at any of these sort of classifications, you can always find flaws in them. They never really fit. And so in the same way, the, say, political classifications that we have don't really fit people because their opinions are always too complicated, unless they're quite stupid, to be able to be fitted into any of these divisions in a precise way. But nevertheless, you can't do without classification of this sort. You can't do without spectra. We used to have a sergeant in training in the army in England who used to teach us about rifle shooting. And he said, "Today we's going to practice aiming off for wind.
Now there are three kinds of wind: mild, fresh, and strong. And three kinds of wind. There you are, stuck with it. You see, because as always, you can always think of this extreme, that extreme, and something in the middle. See? Well, now, you've got something a little richer to play with if you have eight instead of four. And that's the sort of thing that the I Ching classification is based on. Now then, that was Fu Shi, who was supposed to have invented these things. And there is another legend that he saw these trigrams by heating the shell of a tortoise until it cracked, and then studying the cracks. In the same way, Leonardo da Vinci used to go to a filthy old wall where there were all sorts of bird droppings and scratches and markings, and he would do a Rorschach blot on it, and he would see a great battle scene, and this would give him inspiration for a painting. This is the same thing that you do when you gaze in a crystal ball or when you look into a deep pool of ink. There are all sorts of ways of what is called divining. To divine is to consult the oracle. It's like a word. To divine, you see, there's a subject called divinity, which is to do with the scriptures. So to divine is to study the oracle, just as Wittgenstein wanted to make a verb out of philosophy. Philosophy, he always thought, to do philosophy. Philosophy isn't just a subject, it's an activity. And so to divine is to call upon the unconscious. Instead of thinking something out in a logical way, you allow your imagination to flow into something that is useful for an oracle, whether it's a Rorschach blot or a crystal ball or a hexagram of the Book of Changes. For after Fu Shi, King Wen combined the eight trigrams, and there are obviously 64 possible combinations of eight. And so the Book of Changes is simply a setting out of the 64 hexagrams with a commentary on them. And when you are a beginner in the art of the Book of Changes, you need the book. You look up the commentary to help you find out what the hexagram means. But when you are an expert, you don't need the book. You simply feel the meaning of these combinations of two elements. Now, the theory of the Book of Changes is a very curious one. And it's related to Jiji Muge, that is to say, the mutual interpenetration of all things and events, and is based on the idea that anything that happens at this moment will be related to this moment because it's in the context of this moment. Therefore, the way I would do something at random at this time will be what we call a sign of the times, or a manifestation of what in German is called the Zeitgeist, the spirit of the time, or the mind of the time. Another way of putting it would be the configuration of the time. And it's in the same way that, for example, astrologers cast what is called a horary horoscope. That is to say, as of the moment, what are the stars? What is, in other words, the configuration of the universe? And so, in exactly the same way, the I Ching philosophy is based on the idea that how one randomly selects the yarrow stalks, or the sticks, or tosses coins in a given situation, and you might define the situation by asking a question, that random pattern that falls will be related to the situation, and you can divine something about the situation from it. I remember a Zen master who used to use the I Ching. He had another way. He would take anything. He took, for example, one day a bowl of flowers, and he looked at the pattern of the arrangement of the flowers and derived a hexagram from the pattern. And from that, he told us about the mood the person who had arranged them had been in. Now, of course, this is all, from our scientific point of view, unverified and may be unverifiable. And of course, a scientific person pooh-poohs this kind of thing. Because he would say, that's not the way to go about deciding what to do in an important situation. Or when you have to decide upon action in an important situation, what you do if you're a scientifically minded person is you study all the relevant data and you get information. And then on the basis of that information and past experience and previous scientific studies of behavior, you decide how this situation is likely to turn out. But there is a very serious problem about that. It is not any use for practical purposes. It is only applicable in trivial situations, which are highly controlled in an experimental way. For example, in the old times when you went to the doctor, he would look at you and prod you and smell you and come up with some feeling about what was the matter with you. No doctor will do that today. They say they don't move unless they take innumerable tests. See? So you're tested and measured precisely. Then they come back and they think about it. But you know, they still don't know what to do. Because there comes a point in any decision-making process where you have to act on hunch. How do you know when you've got in enough data about any situation? When to call a halt? Because you can go on collecting data forever. There are always infinitely many variables in any situation whatsoever, and especially in the human situation. So ultimately, you don't kid yourself. You are always deciding on hunch what you're going to do. Even the best informed person ultimately comes to a leap of intuition before making a decision. So then, when you really don't know which way to decide on a certain thing, people say, flip a coin. You know, you can always rib Christians on this because the disciples of Jesus cast lots to make a decision. But we're always doing that. You're always at the point where you don't decide for what we call purely rational reasons. So then, flipping a coin gives you two possibilities, yes or no. Now, let's suppose you had an eight-sided coin. See, six-sided dice is a little bit richer. Instead of giving you only two decisions, possibilities, here you've got a possibility of variation. Now let's consider a 64-sided coin. That's what you've got here. Now, again, when you get the oracle in the I Ching, it is never terribly specific. Although sometimes, in your given situation, it seems to be absolutely specific when you consult it. But on the other hand, you use it like theologians use the Bible. That is to say, they read into it anything they want to find. Only, you mustn't do this deliberately. You have to let your own unconscious processes read the oracle for you and decide what it means. In other words, you use the oracle like a Rorschach blot. And the wisdom of that is this: that your brain, if it is your brain, and nobody really knows, you see, just to put something in parentheses, is the brain the mind? Some say yes, some say no. One would think that the structure of the brain has something to do with the structure of thought. But on the other hand, it may not, in the same sense that a structure of a radio has nothing to do with the message that comes over it. Although Marshall McLuhan says, he belongs to the other school, you see, that the medium itself is the message. What is the relationship, for example, between the grid pattern of a newspaper photograph and the picture? The same grid pattern can convey any picture. So there seems to be a complete irrelevance between the two. But on the other hand, there is not quite as much irrelevance as you might think. Because any picture reproduced by this method has some connection with a time and with a technology that can produce this method. It's a rather roundabout connection, that one. But nevertheless, from a big point of view, it's a very close connection. Depends where, what framework you're looking at it in, whether you've got a very big framework or a very narrow one. But, so when it comes down to it, though, and you don't know how to make a decision, all right, then you consult your brain. Now, I'm using the word brain here to mean a complex organization which you have at your disposal, which you don't understand, and which is much smarter than you are. Because you see, whatever it is that is the mind, the brain, or whatever, I don't care what you call it, it takes care of ever so many things at once which you could never possibly think of consciously. You can't be bothered consciously to regulate your glands, to see that your blood flows all right all the time, but your nervous system is taking care of that. It is regulating it all. Your nervous system is receiving information which you don't know anything about. Because when we look consciously, we by no means notice all that our eyes see. But your mind or brain registers everything that is input to your eyes. So genius in thinking is fundamentally based on being able to trust your own mind and not confuse your mind with the content of conscious perception. The content of conscious perception is a tiny fragment of what's going on around you. You can train yourself to be more receptive than you are in ordinary consciousness. But this isn't quite the point. It is not like, how many things did you notice? You know how you can play a game with children and when they become boring in a car and they get out a pad and write down how many things you noticed as you went along. You know? Scouts play this sort of thing. Well, that's all right, but that's not the point here. The point here is not how much did you notice. Because there's no end to that. You can play that game, and there are infinitely many things that you could notice. The point is to take them all in one glance. And you can't do that with conscious attention, but you do it with your basic neurological or mental equipment, whatever you want to call it. So therefore, you have at your disposal this amazing computer, or whatever it is, that can think multidimensionally, on ever so many levels at once. Now, thousands of years ago, we don't know how far all this goes back, but people naturally trusted their minds to tell them what to do. They didn't make decisions. They did what they felt like. Or, as we should call it, they followed instinct, as animals do. Then they discovered how to figure through language and through numbers. They found that figuring could be very effective. And they started using it and relying on it more and more and more. And as a result of this, developed anxiety. Because when you don't figure and you live purely spontaneously, you never worry. If this decision is disastrous, it's disastrous, and death will hit you in a hurry and you'll never know what hit you. You don't spend all your time worrying about, did you make up your mind in the right way? And you see, that may lead to trouble. But the thing is that people don't realize is that everything leads to trouble in any case. If you develop the intellect and its calculation processes to an excessive degree, what do you have? Well, you have the weapons lab of the United States Air Force, and you have the Russian this, that, and the other, and the Chinese something else. You have planned disaster. If you leave it alone, which is what the Taoists mean, partly by wu wei or non-interference, there will still be troubles in the world, but you won't have to worry about them. And you will float along, and you will feel very free. And the question is to try and con modern people into living that way. Now, I'm putting this, you mustn't take me too literally. Because for a really well-developed human being, he isn't one who simply abandons thinking and planning. Because after all, that is some faculty that we have, in just the same way that a bird has a beak. And you don't want to, as it were, amputate your faculties. The point is rather something like this. We have to recognize the hierarchical situation of our faculties. That the thinking faculty is the servant of the larger mind, which doesn't need to think, just as God, if I may use that expression again, if you asked him, how high is Mont Blanc in millimeters? He would say, well, I really don't know. I'll have to measure it. Because to ask that question is to ask the relation of Mont Blanc to a ruler. Mont Blanc is not in itself any millimeters or meters in height. That is this is simply a short way of talking about comparing it with a scale. And knowing what it is in height is the same thing as comparing it with the scale. So the Lord would have to say, I must get out my ruler. Just in the same way as you don't know how you breathe, but you do it. So the Lord God creates the universe without knowing how it's done. That is to say, knowing in terms of technical considerations. But you still know how to breathe, even if you don't know how you do it, because you do it. That's knowing how to do it. You know how to walk. Do you know how to think? Nobody does. But they do it. So then, this unknown process produces the knowing process. But the knowing process is subordinate to it. And therefore you have to learn how to include thinking in spontaneity. But it's subordinate to spontaneity. That's when I wrote that thing in the bulletin about Suzuki and ended with a quotation in which he described his own life as a thinker, because he was an intellectual, he was a scholar. But he did scholarship in the spirit of spontaneity. He used thinking. He was not used by thinking. And when I say he here, I'm referring to the mind beyond consciousness. Now, the mind beyond consciousness, we discussed a little bit of this yesterday, that we call the self, with a capital S, as distinct from the ego. And I pointed out why the horoscope was traditionally considered to be the map of the soul, and that the body is in the soul, not the soul in the body. So the mind that I am talking about is not merely your nervous system. If we will talk about it now in physical terms, it is not merely the nervous system, but it is the entire physical environment in which your nervous system exists and all the relationships operating within it. That's your mind. In other words, the kind of mind you have at this moment is impossible without your living in this kind of a society. Your mind includes the telephone book, the Encyclopedia Britannica, the University of California, and everything else going on, say, in the intellectual world. Every one of us exists mentally in relation to the total intellectual process going on in this day and age in society. You draw on it, it infiltrates you, it provides you with language. You didn't invent the English language. It was given to you as a result of a social enterprise going on for thousands of years. So in this sense, when you consult your mind, you are consulting the entire organization of the universe as it is immediately, more immediately, reflected in the structure of your nervous system and everything that your nervous system is doing, all the kinds of messages that are running through it. It is these messages that constitute the mind. And so this is what Buckminster Fuller means when he talks about synergy. S-Y-N-E-R-G-Y means the, from the Greek, synergos, working together. And he believes that any organization has more intelligence than any one of its members. And he therefore goes on to believe that the industrial complex of communication systems covering the face of the earth is developing its own intelligence. And it will be much more intelligent than any one of us. And this may perhaps save the situation. We don't know. I mean, one illustration of this is that I'm very familiar with is air transportation. Now, every country in the world has invested a fortune in jet aircraft. And by Jove, these things have to run, otherwise they fall apart. So they must run on time. And this network of air communications is joining every city in the world together so that by 1968, according to Buckminster Fuller, we have a one-town world. Figure it. If it takes you an hour to get from here to New York in a supersonic craft, New York is only as far away as Palo Alto. Well, that's practically in the same community. And this is going to include Tokyo and Moscow and Paris and so on, and they're all going to become the same place. They'll speak increasingly the same language, share the same culture, eat the same food. You can fly in San Francisco bread to Paris, which is being done because some of the bread made here is better than the bread made in Paris. You know, it can go the other way too. And we're going to share a common urban culture. And this is the work of synergy. Also, the aircraft people get increasingly bored at passport and customs regulations because they hold up traffic. Well, now, then, you might like to see how the I Ching is used. And I have here, mainly for symbolic reasons, three ancient Chinese coins. You will see that they have a square hole in the middle and that on one side they're inscribed and on the other side they're not. And the inscribed side is counted as the yin face and the uninscribed side is counted as the yang. And when you use the Book of Changes, you usually face it with a question. And it seems to me that a good question that it might be faced with is, what should the people of the United States do about China? And you respectfully request the wisdom of the oracle in this matter, and you throw the coins down to see how they fall. And what I have is one yang and two yins. Now, strangely enough, that counts in this system, and I don't quite know why, as what's called the yang yang. I think maybe I do know why. You would think it would be a yin with two yins and one yang, but it counts as the yang yang, and that's the bottom line of the hexagram. And by being a yang yang, it means it's a fixed line. It doesn't change. Perhaps the reason why that's called the yang yang is that when you've got two yins and one yang, it means the yin is weakening and the yang is coming up. Because when you reach a point at which the yin force comes to a maximum, there is in it the seed of the yang force. And vice versa. And you see, you have to do this six times to get six lines. And so this time we have two yangs and one yin, which gives us the yang yin. And that again is a line which doesn't change. We get two yins and one yang, which gives us another yang yang, and has made the hexagram of water. No, fire. And this time we get three yin, which gives us a changing yin line, which is written like this. That means that after you consult the hexagram in its first form, you consult the hexagram which is, so far as that line is concerned, the opposite. Again, two yins and one yang, giving us the yang yang. And we get here two yangs and one yin, which gives us the yang yin. And so we get fire over water. No, water over fire. Water over fire. Cool it, baby. So that is five over sway, sway, sway. Yeah. Lee. Can't remember Lee. 63. And
see, the oracle is often very surprising. 63. Gigi, meaning after completion. This hexagram is the evolution of Tai, or the hexagram number 11, meaning peace. The transition from confusion to order is completed, and everything is in its proper place, even in particulars. The strong lines are in the strong places, the weak lines in the weak places. This is a very favorable outlook, yet it gives reason for thought. For it is just when perfect equilibrium has been reached that any movement may cause order to revert to disorder. The one strong line that has moved to the top, thus effecting complete order in details, is followed by the other lines, each moving according to its nature. And thus suddenly there arises again the hexagram P, number 12, which is standstill. Let's see, we are going to move to... Now, here comes the oracle itself. It says, after completion, which is the name of the hexagram. Success in small matters. Perseverance furthers. At the beginning, good fortune. At the end, disorder. Then following the judgment comes another part of the oracle called the image. Water over fire. The image of the condition in after completion. Thus the superior man takes thought of misfortune and arms himself against it in advance. And then there's a comment on the lines. And we have an eight in the... a six in the fourth place. And the oracle here says, of this line, which is a moving one, the finest clothes turn to rags. Be careful all day long. Now, there are many comments on this. But we should look first at the hexagram it turns into, which is number, 43, I think I said. Yeah. 47. Turns into 47. Well, the one it turns into indicates the direction of the motion of the... It turns into kun, which means oppression or exhaustion, with the lake above and the water below. The judgment is oppression, success, perseverance. The great man brings about good fortune, no blame. When one has something to say, it is not believed. The image. There is no water in the lake. The image of exhaustion. Thus the superior man stakes his life on following his will. There is a comment on this one. It says, the lake is above, water below. The lake is empty, dried up. In other words, the water flows out. Exhaustion is expressed in yet another way. At the top, a dark line is holding down two light lines. Below, a light line is hemmed in between two dark lines. The upper trigram belongs to the principle of darkness, the lower to the principle of light. Thus, everywhere, superior men are oppressed and held in restraint by inferior men. Mm-hmm. Now, the commentary on the judgment of the original hexagram reads, "The transition from the old to the new time is already accomplished. In principle, everything stands systematized, and it is only in regard to details that success is still to be achieved. In respect to this, however, we must be careful to maintain the right attitude. Everything proceeds as if of its own accord, and this can all too easily tempt us to relax and let things take their own course without troubling over details. Such indifference is the root of all evil. Symptoms of decay are bound to be the result. Here we have the rule indicating the usual course of history, but this rule is not an inescapable law. He who understands it is in position to avoid its effects by dint of unremitting perseverance and caution." And then the image, which is water over fire. "When water in a kettle hangs over fire, the two elements stand in relation and thus generate energy. But the resulting tension demands caution. If the water boils over, the fire is extinguished and its energy is lost. If the heat is too great, the water evaporates into the air. These elements here brought into relation and thus generating energy are by nature hostile to each other. Only the most extreme caution can prevent damage. In life, there are junctures when all forces are..."